Okay. So this is the mindfulness, the seven factors, the Eightfold Path. And you may have noticed yesterday that I did change the translation, because that was quite a brilliant translation of the word sati, awareness, mindfulness. So we get now, after doing this, is mindfulness of the body, the focus of your mindfulness on the body. Remember, they have all the prerequisites, first of all, having restrained the five hindrances. So the four postures: when walking, you're aware in the present that I am walking. When standing, sitting or lying down, you're aware in the present, lying down. Thus you maintain present moment awareness of however your body is disposed. And remember that one of the prerequisites is that you know the purpose of what you're doing. In other words, you don't just lie down when you are listening to a Dhamma talk by Ajahn Brahm, otherwise you will fall asleep. And that defeats the purpose. So it's aware and is always with these four focuses of mindfulness, an understanding of the purpose, why you're doing these things for. In this way, you're aware of your own body, or you're aware of the bodies of others of the same nature as yours. They get tired, they have the same aches and pains in the knees that you have, sometimes more extreme, sometimes less extreme. Be aware of both your own and others' bodies, or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of the body. Say yesterday, scroll, please. Whoops. Where the body will cease when the four nutriments cease, or you abide contemplating the body's causal nature, both arising and ceasing. Or else mindfulness, it is just a body which is walking, which is sleeping, which is sitting, which is standing, impermanent, suffering, and not me, not mine, and not a soul. It is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom, essential for liberation. Mindfulness and wisdom are essential for liberating from attachment to this burden of having a body. That is another way you are mindful of the body, and now full comprehension of the purpose. In particular here, you act in full comprehension of the purpose when going forward and returning. You act in full comprehension of the purpose when looking ahead and looking away. You don't just do it just for mindlessly. When flexing and extending your limbs, when wearing your clothes and carrying things. And if you may compare that to the translation usually given, it's when wearing your robes and carrying a bowl. So it's a totally monk specific. And so this is for everybody. We're wearing your clothes and carrying things. Why are you wearing clothes for? And you're wearing that to make sure that you don't become offensive by exposing too much. You don't do that just because you're too cold or you're too hot. You do it for the right purposes, where you are and what you're doing. And for example, if you go to a formal function, then you have to dress up. If it's just going for just a casual bit of exercise, you have to wear your sports clothes. So we've always all got different things to wear for different occasions. Except that story when Ajahn Brahm received an invitation for a state dinner with Queen Elizabeth II. Wow, imagine getting an invite like that. And I showed it to the monks, we were all so excited, until you saw dress code. And the dress code for a function like that in Parliament House in Canberra was three options. The first option was black tie. Now, I don't know these things. I was really surprised. Is that all you wear when you go to have dinner with the Queen? No trousers, no underpants, just black. That's what it said. Of course I understood that meant just it's a code word. That's why when you translate stuff, you don't translate the word, you translate the meaning. And black tie means like a suit, you know, nice shirt, black tie for guys, and trousers and shoes. So, we don't have that in the monastery. You just search the monastery, there's not one tie there, so there's not a black one. So, what to do? The next option, the three options, the next option was military dress. Or uniform, sorry. Uniform, we don't. Imagine if you see me in a military uniform, that'd be the end of my reputation. So that was, I was going to be very disappointed, and I'm not going to be able to go. And the third option was long dress. That was me. Yeah, it's meant for the females, but nevertheless, you know, this counts in the 21st century. So anyway, so I wear the long dress. So you're aware, why are you wearing these robes? And, or your clothes? You're acting full comprehension of the purpose regarding eating, drinking, defecating and urinating. What are you doing that for? For health. So you don't just rush it to try and get it out of the way and force it, and then you get your sicknesses of hemorrhoids. Walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, being awake, talking and keeping silent. Hang on. You're acting full comprehension of the purpose when sleeping? How can you be aware when you're asleep? And what it means is the awareness is not always in this present moment. We have something we call Pachavekana Jnana, which is the reflective awareness. So your awareness of the purpose of sleeping. Not while you're asleep, that's impossible. But, you know, before you go to sleep and when you wake up in the morning, have you had enough? Is it just to escape? Because when I was teaching in the prisons, they would always say they'd like to sleep as much as they could because one extra hour of sleep was 1 hour off your sentence. You can understand that logic. So, the purpose of sleeping. So, this becomes important later on when you are mindful of, just aware, contemplate, especially if you've had a deep meditation, what happened there, why did that happen, and you get some great insights. When you're mindful of something which has just happened. In this way you are being awake, talking and keeping silent. Full comprehension of the purpose of talking. So why do you talk so much? I'm not criticizing, it's up to you to find out why. Has it got a purpose or is it just, you know, causing problems? And keeping silent, why do you keep silent? Silence is golden. And it's wonderful when you can communicate to one another, just with body language, just in silence, a little smile, worth a thousand words. In this way you are aware of your own body, you're aware that the bodies of others are the same nature as yours, and you're quite aware of both your own and others' bodies. Well, you're quite aware what causes the arising of the body, the four nutriments, or you're quite aware the body will cease when the four nutriments cease, or you're quite contemplating the body's cause and nature of both arising and ceasing. It goes on each one of these. Oh, yes, mindfulness is just the body, impermanent suffering and not me, not mine, not the soul. It is establishing you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom essential for liberation. And you're quite independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is another way that you are mindful of the body. And you know you're liberated from this body when the doctor comes along and says, I'm sorry sir, you have a cancer, you've only got it for 6 months to live. And you say, can't you make it sooner? Can't you fast track it? Oh, the great Kesari Dharmananda in Malaysia, who the doctor, talked to the doctor who actually reported this, when he was told his cancer was terminal and he had no chance of any survival, he's going to die soon, he burst out laughing. Yay! I'm out of here. So he's the first person this doctor ever noticed who laughed when he was face certain death. The bodily parts. So you review your body from head to toe, bounded by skin, is made up of many kinds of parts, blood and bones, tissues and organs. If you look at the original, it goes a whole list of 31 parts. And if you're a doctor, you say, well, come on, they've got much more refined than that these days. And so I just said, blood and bones, tissues and organs, dot, dot, dot. just as though a full shopping bag with many kinds of groceries, such as bread and potatoes, fruit and vegetables. You know, you say, the many types of rice, the hill rice, paddy rice, yellow rice, red rice, and whatever it is in the original. And that never really sort of made much sense to me. So, but when you put bread, potatoes, fruit and vegetables, yeah, I've been shopping before. So too you review this same body, it's full of many parts, thus in this body there are hairs and bones, shit and urine. And that's another way you are mindful of the body. Or the elements. You view this body by way of the elements. In this body there are the earth element, water element, fire element, and the air element. That is another way you are mindful of the body. And when I first read that, as a physicist, I thought, that's so old. Four elements? And it doesn't make any sense anymore to me, those elements. So, but anyway, just put them down as a very short. If I really had the guts, I would say, the three quarks. Or the fundamental particles of existence are listable. But the problem is, they always try to reduce these things to the basic building blocks of stuff, and they just can't do it. Nothing ever fits. Every time they find one particle, they find another particle which don't fit in. So any of you who got bamboozled by the discovery, so-called discovery, of the Higgs boson, the God particle. Number one, you know, it's not really conclusive. It's inferential. Yeah, it looks like there may be one there. And nobody ever found maybe one. And they got Nobel Prizes for that. And it's not replicable. They haven't done it again. So, and some of the other particles that turned up, they didn't know what the heck was going on there. So they had to sort of do a little bit of spin. You know, because if they said actually what they was really true, they would not get any Nobel Prize. The $1 billion project would get shut down because they had to give their sponsors, you know, something to get excited about. So anyway, four elements, yeah, it's good enough. Well, just what this stuff is made up of. You can use four elements, you can use protons and neutrons, the periodic table, whatever you want, but just to say this is just all this stuff is. But what was nice, what I said the other day about the positive, not emotional, but positive and negative energy, physical stuff. And if it all comes together, all the material energy of this whole universe, the mass energy of the universe comes together, it disappears. A zero-sum universe. That was really cool. To actually to see that is how modern science understands this. So there is nothing here. It just separated out and just from nothing. We came from nothing. We separated out and we go back to nothing. Nothing. No bank accounts, no gold, no Mr. Trump, no Mount Everest, no sun, nothing. All coming back and disappears. That is just so wonderful. Bring it on. Anyway, the nine channel ground contemplations. This is, again, to get people free from their attachments to your bodies. It's just body, that's all. So you see a corpse. In the old days, they would throw corpses in the channel ground and just let nature take its course. You see a corpse thrown aside in a china ground, up for 3 days old, bloated, livid, and oozing matter. Then you reflect on your own body is the same nature. Some bodies are already oozing. It may become like that, it's not exempt from that fate. Or you see a corpse thrown aside in a china ground being devoured by birds, animals, or maggots. Then you reflect your own body is the same nature. It may become like that, it's not exempt from that fate. Or you see a corpse thrown aside in a china ground, a skeleton with flesh and blood held together with sinews, a flesh of skeleton smeared with blood held together with sinews, a skeleton without flesh and blood held together with sinews. Disconnected bones scattered in all directions, bones bleached with white, the colour of shells, bones heaped up, bones more than a year old, rotted and crumbled to dust. Then you reflect that your own body is the same nature. It may become like that, it is not exempt from that fate. Again, just to get you, you know, out of the idea, some people are just so beautiful, some people are so ugly, some people, it's only your body, some people are so fat, Some people are so thin, we all end up the same. Fat or thin, beautiful or ugly, tall or short, you're just going to end up as bones turned to dust.
Okay.
Yeah?
Is that probably a super practice?
It is. They call it a super practice because we're trying to, if we've got lots of lust, and say, oh, she's the most beautiful woman in the world. You know what Ajahn Chah's take on that. That monk, I was there at the time, his name was Gary from, he's actually from LA, and he was thinking of his girlfriend. You know, he'd just become a novice. And we're driving in the back of a car, Ajahn Chah in the passenger seat, myself, the translator, and Gary in the back seat, and Ajahn Chah turned around. You've got to be careful thinking unmonkish thoughts when Ajahn Chah was around. He turned around and said, you're thinking of your girlfriend, aren't you? Busted. Because he was. And poor old Gary felt so sorry for him. And he felt embarrassed. And then Ajahn Chah smiled. He's such a compassionate monk. He said, I can help you. Next time you write to your girlfriend in LA, tell her to send something of her, something personal, so that when you miss her, you can take it out and smell it, and so you won't feel so apart from her. Is that really allowable? Like, you know, asking for a lock of her hair, or, you know, a bit of a dress or something with her perfume on? Is that okay? I said, oh yeah. That's why he's such a great monk to be around. He was just so unconventional and full of fun. So, and then Ajahn Chah said what to do. And the translator, he was almost falling out of the car, laughing his head off. And I wanted to find out what the translation was, because my Thai was not that good then. And then when he did bring himself to say what Ajahn Chah said, yeah, that's allowable, you can do that. But don't get a lock of her hair or a piece of her dress. Ask her to get a tiny bottle and put some of her shit in the bottle. And send it to you. So when you miss her, you can take out the cork of the bottle and, oh, that's my beautiful girlfriend back in LA. It was just so gross. It was so funny. And so true. Don't you say, I love everything about you, my darling. Oh, she's so gorgeous. She's so wonderful. Yeah, go with her to the toilet and then you come to your reality. Same thing goes to guys as well. It's just human beings, that's all. Anyway, so that's, you know, if you've got too much lust and, you know, you want to lessen the lust, you know, then this is what you do, a super practice. You have to be careful because you don't want to go into negative. It's just a balance. You're going, girls are just like toothpaste tubes. They've just got shit inside them, squeeze them too much and something will come out at the end. I've seen mice get so gross with things like that. And so it's only to balance. If we are really hate characters, we're always negative, then actually we do the loving kindness meditation. So we always balance it. But it's great to actually to see the real nature of the body, so you don't just get caught up in worship of bodies. Otherwise, that.
What do you think, Ajahn? I came across an sober monk recently,
yeah,
who was showing pictures of accident, body split, wide open,
yeah, I know,
and all those horrible things.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I mean, that's, people look at that. That might need some therapy. He's sick,
okay.
And sometimes. Could people do that? And it just goes too far. And especially, you know, it's going to be wonderful to encourage people to respect the Buddha's teachings. And as they say, oh, that's all the monks do all day. So it is overdone, but it needs to. It's like anything. If you're lacking salt in your diet, you put a bit of extra salt. If you've got low iron in your blood, you take extra iron. If you've got too much iron, you take less. It's all a balance. So you see, if a person's negative, it's not something which fits all people. Because you know what the purpose of this is. So it's just a body, that's all. You don't get negative for a body and you get weird about it. But it is really fascinating. When I was a kid in London, they had a program, only 5 minutes, once a week, and it was just showing about operations on an operating table, cutting people's bodies up. And as soon as it came on, both my mother and father and brother had to leave the room. They wanted to actually to stop it, but I said, educational. And that was so I could get anything which I wanted on TV if it was educational. So I would watch it, and I was fascinated by it. And even when you did get the chance to watch operations as a monk, or autopsies especially, there was no disgust there. I thought it was really fascinating. As a doctor, just have a look inside the body and see how it all works. So I know some people think it's their faith at the sight of blood, or they sort of just they can't stand it. But I thought it was really interesting. Not in a macabre sense, but just, you know, science. Understand how everything works. When you first actually took out a brain, the brain is so small. And I thought, wow, that small little thing causes so much problems. That was fascinating that way. But that is, you don't sort of go over to negativity. If it goes to negativity, it goes too far.
Ajahn, can I ask the first part of this talk where we talked about, you know, when you're walking, you're walking. Is that something that we're supposed to maintain on a day-to-day basis as you go about?
No. Because if you are driving a car with me in the passenger seat, you don't just be mindful of sitting, that's my posture, be aware of sitting. You're aware of the traffic. Otherwise, you kill yourself, and me too. So you know the purpose of this. Why are you doing it? And of course, it is just to focus your awareness in this moment. You know, you feel you're here, you're walking, you're sitting, or you're lying down. What's the purpose of that? Why are you lying down? If it's to go to sleep, fine, lay down comfortably. If you're doing the lying down meditation, then you can lie down to meditate in your room, but don't lie down on your pillow. If you lie down on your pillow in the position you usually go to sleep, and you try to be awake, of course you'll fall asleep. Psychology, brain says this is lying down, this is sleeping position, therefore I go to sleep. So I always go to sleep on my sides or on my front sometimes. I never go to sleep on my back. I just got out of the habit of that. So I reserve lying on my back for meditation. So if I want to, and especially if you're in a hospital, you're sick or something, I lie on my back, and because my brain knows that it's not sleeping posture, then you don't go to sleep, you don't get sleepy. But if I go on my side, the brain says, okay, he wants me to go to sleep. So I go to sleep. So that's why if you want to do the lying down posture, to be aware and be mindful and meditate, make sure it's a position which you don't normally fall asleep in. And then it will work. Okay, so you just understand what this body is. And it also, I mean, people do have lust, and everybody has to control their lust. It doesn't matter whether you're a monk or you've got a husband and wife. Not both, but just one, I mean, husband or wife. Which means, you know, you're committed to someone in this life. And of course, you know, you're a human being. Husbands will see a beautiful girl, not their wife. Maybe in the office, you know, you're around a long time. And of course, you know, you get some lust coming up. So use these, you know, to try and make sure you don't break your precepts and do something stupid. The same with women, it does take two to tango. It can't be just the man just unfaithful. So you use that to restrain yourself. You've got one partner, that's enough. And you restrain yourself using the same things which the monks use. Now we've got no partner. And so, especially when I was a young monk, you know, instead of a super, I would always look for the girl's pimples. And it wasn't perfect. That was just my way of doing things. And no matter what beautiful girl came into the monastery, this was in Thailand. I told you the Thai, not Thai girls, the Thai girls, they were the ones who killed you. And if you're a human being, you saw something there which, oh, she's really nice. and then you look for something which is negative. When I went into prisons, you see, oh, this guy is really dangerous. And then you look for something beautiful in him, something kind. So you just balance your perceptions of people. So when you saw a woman, it could be a supermodel, it could be a TV star, film star. They're a human being. So you take away that sort of sex thing, attraction thing, and they see them as a human being. Take away the negativity, oh, they're dangerous, they've, you know, raped people. Take that away and look at the other part of them. So it balances. So you can actually relate to a person. So it's a balancing. Oh, this way you're aware of your own body, aware of the bodies of others of the same nature as yours, you abide aware of both your own and others' bodies, or else you abide aware of what causes the arising of the body, the four nutriments, so you abide aware of the bodies of nature disease. When the four nutriments cease, or you abide contemplating the body's cause or nature, or else mindful is just the body, impermanent suffering and not me, not mine, not a soul, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom, essential liberation, may you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is another way you are mindful of your body. And the benefits. When mindfulness of body has been repeatedly practiced and developed, the 10 benefits may be expected. You overcome delight and discontent. Most of delight and discontent is about a body, you know, that... I still remember this about 13 or 14 year old girl who came to me, her father brought me for counselling. She was really depressed and expecting her school work, and also that the psychologist couldn't really help her. And so I asked her, what's your problem? And she said, my nose is too big. That's what I said, it's really cute. And maybe you can remember when you were 13 or 14 years of age. You know, you looked at something, there's two bad bricks in the wall, that's what it was. He said, my nose is too big. And I decided to be a scientist. And I said, okay, look, I'm not going to touch you, but I'm going to look at your nose and measure it with my mind. And I said, actually, your nose is pretty average. It's not the most beautiful nose in the world, but it's certainly not the biggest nose in the world. If you want a big nose, that, you know, Gerald Depardieu, that French guy, he's really got a big nose. But it's okay. But, you know, for her, it didn't wash. And that sort of thinking she had a big nose was actually ruining her life. And so she wasn't really aware of her body, she was aware of images. And that's why she has so much discontent. That's why you have girls get anorexia. So much discontent with their own body. Oh, you delight in your own body, and then when it starts to get a bit old, you have to use Botox or anything else. Because we identify the body, this is me, this is important. You overcome fear and dread, it's only your body, that's all. So, you know, if it gets injured or whatever, you have pain, but dying is not such a big deal. You bear cold and heat, hunger and thirst, contact with flies, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, and creeping things. You endure unwelcome words and there is embodied feelings of a pain from a medicine to life, because you're not so concerned about your body. You care for it, you look after it, but you're only a visitor. You care for your room here in China Grove, but you're not going to get really worrying about it and think, oh, you know, I should renovate this room. I'm going to paint it a new colour because I don't like the colour it is now. And I'm going to change the basement to something different. And the curtains, we could do much better than that. You don't do that, you're only visiting for a few days. So you don't have any feelings about this body, about your room. It's just a room, that's all. You know its purpose, and then the body. You can endure feelings of the pain. Maybe we scrolled down too much, didn't we? Mm-hmm. Contact with life, body feels the pain from medicine to life. And you experience whatever needs without difficulty the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind, divine present abiding this very life. Why is that? Because a lot of those hindrances, especially the main one, attachment to this body, and with it the five senses. So the body almost equals these five senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And there does come a time, if you haven't come across it yet, fear. When your body starts to vanish. Woo! I can't feel my hands. I can't feel my legs. I can't feel my head. What's going on? It is vanishing. It's wonderful. So when you understand what the body is, you can let it go. So it's much easier to allow the body to disappear, to allow the past and future to disappear, and all the senses. The senses are there. One of the reasons it's so hard to let go of listening to people, listening to sounds, is because sounds are our last defense mechanism. It's just like where we were evolved, our body evolved. We'd hear the danger by hearing in the jungle the snake crawling towards us, the tiger stalking us. And we couldn't see it, but we could hear it. So you find, especially at night time, you hear sounds. And that's like your alarm system. So that's why it's so hard to let go of sound if you're really attached to your body. So, and after jhanas, you wield the various kinds of supernormal power. And even though the chances of getting any one of these is just so remote, you like hearing about them. This is cool stuff. Having been one, you can become many. You can appear in many places at the same time. Having become many, you become one. And apparently, that was actually stolen in a movie. Was it Matrix? Where these guys became same guys at many, many places. And you appear and vanish. You go unhindered through a wall or through a mountain or so through space. That's like David Copperfield did that, didn't he? Walk through the Great Wall of China. That's fake. And you through a mountain through space. You dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. You walk on water without sinking as though it were earth, like Donald Trump the other day. Seated cross-legged, you travel in space like a bird. You wield mastery even as far as the Brahma world. That's psychic power that people are really interested in. And with clairaudience and divine ear, you hear sounds, both heavenly and human. Those are the far as well as near. You can read the minds of other persons. Having encompassed them with your own mind, especially whether the mind is affected by one of the five hindrances or whether it's in jhana. You can recollect your past lives, even up to 100,000 births and many eons of expanding universes, many eons of decaying universe. There I was so named as such a family, with such an appearance. Such was my food, my experience of pleasure and pain, my life term and passing away from now reappeared in this other place, and there too I was so named as such a family, such my life term and passing away from there, I reappeared here. Thus with their aspects in particular you can relate many of your past lives. And with clairvoyance of divine ear, you can see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior, superior, fair and happy, fortunate, unfortunate. One understands how beings are reborn according to their actions. You can see ghosts and devas which other people can't see. By realizing for yourself with direct experience in this life, you enter upon and abide in the deliverance of the mind and deliverance by wisdom, your own enlightened one. And of all those psychic powers, the Buddha said that's the only one which is worth anything. Just the wisdom and being enlightened. Because the other ones make people really scared. So a nice, interesting story for you. People love weird stuff. But this was, many Indonesian people here. Remember that monk Sudarmo? He passed away a few years ago? Yes. You know him, yet? Yeah. Because I met him. He was real, real psychic powers, very powerful monk. And he was teaching in Wat Pawon in Bangkok, in the Royal Monastery. And the lady, she was a princess, she told me this, and known her for a long time, no lying there. She was meditating just like you meditate here. And she felt something was wrong, something was going on. And she opened her eyes to have a peek, not supposed to. And she saw from this monk lasers coming out of his eyes into one of the meditators. Not imagining it, not crazy, real seeing lasers coming out right into this person. And she never went there again. She was so afraid.
Real true story. That's cool, isn't it?
Yeah.
Laser eyes. Would you like to see that?
Yeah.
No, you would. You'd never come back again. Oh, I'd never come back again because someone arrests me and just do experiments on me. But they do happen. But the reason is we don't say too much about it. If a person's alive, we can really keep it quiet. Once they're dead, you know, it doesn't really matter. They don't sort of bother him. Because if, you know, they said that when he was alive, everyone would be bugging him all the time. Come on, turn on your laser eyes. I want to see your laser eyes. So that's why. It's weird and stuff you see. Anyway, rising and passing away. Now this, when people talk about Satipatthana, they would say rise and fall, it doesn't mean that, it means a rising and passing away. And this is the sutta here. Well, I teach you the origination and the passing away of the four focuses of mindfulness. So this is like where the Buddha says what he means by, you notice the rising of the body, the passing away of the body, the rise and fall of the body. It doesn't mean rise and fall, it means arising and passing away. One, supported by the four nutriments, these the origination and continuance of the body. With the cessation of the four nutriments, the body ceases. The four nutriments are food, six sense contacts, experience, will and consciousnesses. That's why I say, if you want to keep somebody alive in hospital, just stimulate them with some sensory contact, talk to them, stroke them. Whatever, just to keep them sort of alive. Or, interestingly, people with dementia, you know, they're losing their mind, stimulate them with music from their era. And you start playing music, and then people who haven't really communicated for long start singing along with you. Which is, you know, you're actually just stimulating their mind and brain, because otherwise it passes away without six sense contacts. And supported by the four nutriments, supported by the six sense contacts, is the origination of experience. So you need sort of the senses to turn on. To have experience. So experience isn't out there, always there. You've got to see things first. And that was, any physicist here, that is quantum physics. And before you actually observe and do some sort of mental observation, the world is just a bunch of probabilities. It may be this, it may be that, but the world doesn't exist when you're not there. It needs to be observed before you create the world. And supported by nama rupa, the objects of consciousness, there's the origination of the citta. With the cessation of nama rupa, the citta ceases. And I love quoting that one, that's straight from the word of the Buddha, because people still say the citta is permanent, there is an original mind, a cosmic consciousness, the ground of all being mind. Sounds nice and appealing, but the Buddha just says, no way. This mind, consciousness, whatever you call it, only exists when there is object for it to know. And those objects cease. Or even if they just stay still, it disappears, the mind turns off. So similar, the best example now similarly is a computer screen. You don't click anything, nothing happens there, it just turns off. And supported by attention is the origination of mind objects. With the cessation of attention, the mind objects cease. So you have a problem in the mind, such as, you know, wandering thoughts. You attend to them, they're a problem, and then they'll keep carrying on. But you don't pay attention to them, they're not important, and then they cease. Actually, I should give you a simile, because it's a very lovely simile, of what to do with distractions when you're meditating, such as you're aware, say, of your breathing, and somebody slams a door, someone has a conversation outside, or, you know, I don't know what else might happen, you may have an itch on your foot or something. Use a simile of a screen. When you have a screen, and I got this by watching those safety demonstrations on the back seat of the aircraft. You know, sitting there, and it turned itself on, You know, and have to watch a safety demonstration. Your safety is of importance. Your safety is a priority, whatever other Gomayang they say. That's not a priority, it's making money is a priority. But, and you watch it then, I noticed that when it first, before it was turned on, I could see the upholstery on the back of the seat. But then once it was turned on, I couldn't see the upholstery anymore. My mind had actually gone into the screen. And I couldn't even see the edges of the screen. All I could see was just a little picture happening. And I'd actually zoomed in, and that had just disappeared from my screen. And that's all I could see, the safety demonstration. And, you know, sometimes you go to people's houses and you see these huge screens. It's exactly the same experience. Nowadays you see people watching something on their tiny iPhones. And it's exactly the same experience if you watch a movie or some documentary on your iPhone and you see it on a huge screen. What's the difference? Is the quality any different? If you actually contemplate that, you find it's exactly the same. Your mind just adjusts, it fits in just perfectly into the screen. Big screen or small screen, it fits in. So you don't need the big screens at home because the experience is exactly the same. Small screen, your mind fits in there perfectly. So, what that means for meditation is that if you hear a sound, people talking outside, if you really start to pay attention to that, worry about it, make a problem out of it, you find that goes in the centre of the screen. And your breath falls off the edge. And that's all you're thinking about. So what to do if, you know, if you're in a noisy place and you want to meditate? You put your meditation object, say it's the breath, and imagine a screen and all the sounds are out here somewhere, or the heat in the body, the mosquitoes, wherever you are. They're on the edge of the screen. Don't ever put them in the centre of the screen. Because if you put them in the centre, your problem, your distraction, if that's in the centre of the screen, everything else will fall off and all you see is your problem. And so if you put it on the edge of the screen, sooner or later, you know, you're watching the breath, yeah, you can feel the mosquitoes, yeah, you can hear the noise, but you're not really giving it attention. It's just on the edge somewhere. And you just stay with the breath, and then eventually those things just disappear. You can't feel them anymore. You don't know when they disappear, they just go, just like the upholstery on the back of the aircraft seat in front of you. And that is important because sometimes when people get into deep meditation, they get excited, boom, 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 the heart starts to beat. And it's a real distraction. And if you focus on that heartbeat, it will go on and you lose all the peace and happiness of your meditation. So what to do, whatever object you're there, delightful breath, say, delightful breath and getting sort of really into some really deep stuff and boom, 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 boom. Keep the heart on the edge. Don't focus on it. Keep boom, boom, boom. No, keep the breath nice and peaceful, breath going and breath going out. On the edge, boom, 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 boom. And then after a while, the heartbeat will disappear from your consciousness. Fall off the screen. And then it will just look after itself. That's the way to deal with distractions. So if ever I have to meditate in a really busy place, on the aircraft, every aircraft you go on, there's always children on their babies. Why don't we have a special compartment for babies? So, you know, and they can just, and kids little corner there, they can play around. And just everyone else goes to be so quiet for the long journey. You want to meditate, you want to go to sleep. It's not really baby's fault, it's just...
So do we just put the earplug?
Earplugs, you can put earplugs in, but nevertheless, there's still something goes on. You know, you can't plug your body when it gets an itch or an ache or something. And even with earplugs, you can still hear some sounds. Especially the heartbeat, you can't plug that off. If you think, disconnect that, you're in big trouble. So anyway, that's just how the attention is actually causes that as a mind object. Anyway, mindful of experience. How are you mindful of fate and of this experience which knows your life? When feeling a pleasant experience, you're mindful you feel a pleasant experience, an unpleasant one you mindful you feel an unpleasant experience. When feeling a neutral experience, you're mindful you feel a neutral experience. And they make the difference between a worldly pleasant experience, a worldly unpleasant experience, a worldly neutral experience. Your mind can feel such a worldly pleasant, unpleasant or neutral experience when feeling an unworldly pleasant experience. You are an unworldly unpleasant experience or an unworldly neutral experience. Your mind can feel such an unworldly pleasant, unpleasant or neutral experience. And they usually say worldly stuff which keeps you in this world. In other words, you get really notice the delight of going shopping. Yes, shopping is happiness, but it is a worldly happiness. But the happiness you get when you're sitting here in China Grove, not going shopping, not wanting anything in the world, that's an unworldly one. So the Buddha makes the difference between worldly and unworldly happinesses. Some are to be followed and developed like the unworldly ones. The happiness of peace. The happiness of kindness. Getting angry gives you a buzz. There's always a pleasure in getting angry. People used to say, I really told him off. And they get really alive when you get angry at somebody. There's happiness there. You have to pay for it afterwards. But nevertheless, there's a pleasure there. Otherwise people would not get angry. So, that's a worldly one. The unworldly happiness, forgiveness. Oh, never mind. We all make mistakes. So I forgive you. That sort of happiness is unworldly. Inspiration is unworldly. So especially the joys of letting go, freedom is unworldly happiness. Oh, in this way you are aware of your own experience, you are aware of the experience of others, is the same nature of yours, or you abide mindful of both your own and others' experiences. And I'm really against gender divides and other divides. Look, it doesn't matter, girl, boy, lesbian, gay, experience is experience. You know, we all cry, we all laugh, we always feel this great joy inside of us when we hear something inspiring, and when we see stupid people just making a mess of stuff. And that experience is common to all humanity, and you see that also in animals as well. You see animals feeling really sad, or you see sort of, you know, the animals feeling so peaceful, they're so sensitive. You know, just today when you went over there, all the little parrots feeding away, you can have a look at them and they're just the same as human beings. They just want to have a nice meal, just like you do. And so you let them just enjoy their little stuff. And it's great to see that they're not afraid of human beings anymore, because, you know, we don't disturb them. No more than I disturb you when you're having your lunch. So it's nice when animals can be respected. So you're aware of your own experience, you're aware that the experience of others, including parrots, is of the same nature as yours, or you abide mindful of both your own and parrots' experience. Parrots are an example. Or else you are by and aware of what causes the arising of experience, it's just sensory contact. Or you are by and aware that experience of nature to cease when sensory contact ceases. Or you are by contemplating experience as causal nature, both arising and ceasing. And it cannot maintain the same. That's why even as a lay person, when I heard the idea that if you're really, really good, you can go to heaven and live happily ever after, that never made any sense to me. And I was actually impressed when I read some of St. Augustine. He was one of the early church theologians who said, this is Christian heaven. He said, every year, one day a year, everybody gets sent to hell for the day. Even the really good people. Because otherwise they wouldn't appreciate heaven. And he had a good point. If you're in heaven day in, day out, it would just be normal. So, now he was an early church father, and saying you can't have happiness without suffering. Otherwise, it just is neutral. So all happiness is because of suffering, is to cease. You never feel so healthy as when you've just recovered from a disease. And after that, it becomes normal. The only reason why people say, in Hong Kong, get really happy if they win, say, a medal in the Olympic Games. It's because all the times they don't win a medal. So in the United States, they don't go bananas when somebody wins a gold medal, because so many other people do. So your happiness is always as a result of suffering. When the happiness disappears, suffering. Anyway, so you're happy being here in Jhana Grove? You'll be suffering in a couple of days' time. The more happy you are, the more it's going to hurt when you leave. Okay, anyway, it rises and passes away. It might be just experience, that's all. Impermanent suffering, and not me, not mine, also. You can't control it. Just go with it. Necessary for mindfulness of wisdom, attention to liberation. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. Experience comes, experience goes. So, you know, don't need to experience anymore. So that's why people say, oh, you haven't lived until you've seen a sunset over the Himalayan mountains. You haven't lived until, what else do people want to do? They call them bucket lists. Absolutely crazy. If you have a bucket list, please put the first thing you have to do on your bucket list is throw away the bucket. And then you're free. That's the first thing on my bucket list. And that's how I meditate, advise my blue experience. Next, English, the mind is pretty simple. The third, mindfulness of the chitta. How are you mindful of the mind? You understand the mind, you're not mindful of it. The word actually changes here. You understand, prajanati, panya. You understand a mind that is affected by wanting as such, and a mind that is unaffected by wanting as such. And it's important here, the word is not mindful of this stuff, it's understanding it. Because you understand a mind that is affected by aversion as such and a mind that is unaffected by aversion as such. If you're really angry, you're not really mindful at all. If you're angry at someone, your mindfulness is on the object of mindfulness. So the object of anger. That little bastard over there who keeps banging the door every time I'm about to get into jhana and blah blah blah. You notice when you're angry, you are mindful of the person, you're blaming something. You're not mindful of how it feels. If anyone was really mindful of how it feels when you're angry, you'd never get angry again. So it's always your mindfulness is out there, not the right thing. So you understand a mind, you understand it, you get to know it. It is affected by aversion, you understand a mind that is unaffected by aversion as such. You understand a mind that is affected by delusion as such, and a mind that is unaffected by delusion as such. That's why you can't be mindful of delusion. Because when it's actually there, you're deluded. You can't see it properly. You understand an exalted mind, a surpassed mind, a still mind. Oh, sorry, I didn't finish this. You understand a contracted mind is contracted because of dullness and drowsiness, and a distracted mind is distracted because of restlessness and remorse. Those are the four first hindrances there. Oh, I didn't get my craving. Oh, I'm saying my state by wanting it. Wanting, aversion, delusion, that's standards that are out there. And contracted mind, dullness, distracted because of restlessness. And that is actually an interesting analogy for sloth and torpor. Your mind is really small and narrow. So, you know, it's contracted. And a mind of restlessness, it's not expanding. If you expand the mind, that's loving kindness. But this is distracted, here, there, all over the place. Contracted, small-minded is dull and deluded. Distracted all over the place, but expanded mind, that's always the loving kindness. You understand the exalted mind, a surpassed mind, a still mind, a liberated mind. All these words are all referring to the dharmas. And an exalted, not still, not liberated mind as such. In this way, you're aware of your own jitta, you're aware that other jittas are the same nature as yours. You're by the aware of both your own and others' jittas, mind. Now, it's from there that I sort of develop the peaceometer. Similarly, so you are aware of whether your mind is distracted, you understand it's distracted, it's peaceful, and that's actually the straight down the line third Satipatthana. When I ask you to do that in the beginning of your meditation, you're aware of that quality of your mind which is peaceful or agitated. And it's great to be able to get into that pretty quickly. And I must admit, I got this from a psychologist who, you know, I was helping somebody and sitting in. And the psychologist, well, you know, if give me a number from 1 to 10, just, you know, how much this hurts. And all it was really doing is putting the person's mindfulness, you know, on that thing inside the body which registers pain or not so much pain. Or, you know, how tired do you feel? Give it a number from 1 to 10. You know, standard little psychology practice. Just doesn't matter what number they come up with. What matters is they're looking at the little place. They can sort of be aware of it to give some sort of number, which they usually pluck from the air. So when I ask you, how peaceful are you? How agitated are you? Straight away you become aware, you know that nature of your mind. Peaceful, really peaceful, or really tense, agitated. And once you see that, then you can understand what things cause this. So, what causes the arising of the jitta, or what causes it to cease? You by contemplating the jitta's causal nature, both the rising and ceasing. Well, mindfulness is just a jitta, just a mind, it's impermanent, it comes and goes, it's not yours, not mine or the soul. It's establishing you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom, this ancient liberation. It's not your mind. So the whole point of this practice is to lose your mind. But not in the sense where people think. You don't become crazy. Unless you think I'm crazy, and I think a few of you have your suspicions. But no, this is actually no losing your sort of identification, this is me. So there we go. That is mindful of the mind. And tomorrow we don't have a sutta class. But can we just go on a... We've got the time with the Indonesians after this. So I think we could just finish off the Satipatthana. It's not that much more now. Mindfulness of mind objects. How are you mindful of mind objects? The five hindrances. You are mindful of mind objects in terms of the five hindrances. When there was wanting regarding the five senses, you are mindful there was such wanting. When there was no wanting, you understand that there was no wanting. You're mindful there's no such wanting. You also understand how such wanting arises, how to let go of such wanting, how such wanting doesn't arise again. Same with aversion, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse and doubt. You understand a mind which has those things. And when it doesn't have those things, and why? What causes wanting? You know, one of the things which causes wanting is just boredom. You're bored. Oh, I want something. You go into the kitchen, you just go and get something to drink. You don't need it. Just something to do. Because we're addicted to doing something. We don't know how to do nothing. We haven't been taught that. So, aversion in you. Is this because two bad bricks in a wall? You're just focusing on part of life, not the whole thing. Being dullness and drowsiness is because you've been working too hard and thinking and worrying. It's just you run out of gas. Restlessness and remorse because you're trying too hard, you want something. And doubt in you, again, because you're thinking too much rather than experience. Just what leads to the right direction, like the simile of the mountains in the mist. And when there's no such doubt, your mind is no doubt, you also understand how such doubt arises, how to let go of doubt, and how doubt doesn't arise again. Suppose you took out a loan and your business was successful, then you repaid the loan and there was enough left over for your own enjoyment and for that of your family. So it's like you'd be grounded full of joy. That is a simile for wanting something. Taking out a loan, you don't need anything. And so when you stop wanting, you can be content. Suppose you were very ill, couldn't eat or sleep, had no strength, later on you recovered, could eat and sleep, and you regained your strength, as a result you'd be grounded full of joy. That's anger, it's like a sickness.
Or you were imprisoned and later were released, safe and secure with no loss to your property, as a result you'd be grand and full of joy. That's the sloth and torpor. You're in a contracted mind, you're in a prison, you can't do anything because you're so tired and so sleepy. That's the problem of people with depression or chronic fatigue. They feel like they're imprisoned in their body with chronic fatigue, they can't do very much. Or depression, imprisoned in this grey part of your mind and you can't find a way out. Or suppose you're a slave, dependent upon others, unable to go where you want. Then later you were released from slavery, independent of others, able to go where you want. As a result, you'd be glad and full of joy. And that is a simile of restlessness. You're a slave. Your will is just like a little dog. You've been led on a leash, first here, first there, all over the place. You don't want to go, but you have to. That's the restlessness. Or suppose you had to travel along a dangerous road across the wilderness, but later you would pass through that wilderness safe and secure with no loss of your property, so it would be grand full of joy. So the wilderness, the desert, you know, with no signposts, that's the result, that's a simile for doubt. So two, when these five hindrances were present, you look back upon them as a debt, wanting, as a disease, a prison, dullness and drowsiness, slavery, restlessness and remorse, and a dangerous road across the wilderness, doubt. When his five hindrances have been abandoned, God says, freedom from debt, health, release from the prison. You're healthy when you don't get angry. Release from the prison, freedom from slavery, and reaching the land of safety. Or the seven enlightenment factors. You're a mind for mind objects in terms of the seven enlightenment factors. When the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is present in you, you understand it's present. But when the enlightenment factor of mindfulness was not present in you, you also understand that it was absent. This is an understanding. You also understand how it comes to be the arising of the absent enlightenment factor of mindfulness, how it comes to fulfillment with development. Understanding how to be mindful, how to be aware. Many people just try and force mindfulness and they can never be mindful, they keep forgetting. Just relax. Mindfulness comes. Conserve your mental energy. Don't think of the past which cannot be changed or worry about the future which you cannot predict. Stay in the present moment, no worries, no anxiety. Your energy increases, you become more and more mindful, more aware, you see more, you can feel more, you're more sensitive. And when you like the fact you're exploring the Dhamma is present in you. Exploring the Dhamma. Remember that simile, what's this? It's not a bot, it's much more than that. You explore and go into it and say, oh, this is interesting. When, like the fact we explore the Dhamma and where you're very mindful, you get energy is present in you. When, like the fact of energy is present in you, it brings you joy, and joy, tranquility, from tranquility to stillness, and stillness, equanimity is present in you. You understand it's present, but when, like the fact of equanimity is not present in you, you understand it was absent. You also understand how there comes to be the rising of the absent enlightenment factor of equanimity and how it comes to fulfillment by development. In the earliest of the Satipatthanas, it finishes there. These are the ones, five components of existence. You can scroll down pretty quickly, I'll run through this quickly. Six sense bases, scroll down, four noble truths. Those actually seem to be added later on. In the earliest Satipatthanas, just those two. Because one is what stops you being enlightened, the other one is describing the process of enlightenment and what enlightenment is like. So one is the antidote of the other. Five hindrances, enlightenment factors. In these ways you are aware of mind objects, you're aware that the other's mind objects are the same nature as yours, or you're quite aware of both your own and other's mind objects. Now one of the freaky things about that, which, now when you get into this, it really brings you goosebumps, when you get into a jhana, which you all will one day, it's too late now, I've planted the seed and it will happen. When you get into a jhana, when you come out afterwards, you should know that your mind, your experience, was the same as other people's in jhanas. No difference at all. At that time, you knew what it was like to be a Buddha. That's what it's like. The same experience, no difference. Buddha's mind. And this is from the Chulahati
Hatika Padogama Sutta. But if you want to find a Buddha, you go into the jhanas. And there you have the four footprints of a Buddha. First, second, third, fourth jhana. So you don't need to go to India to see where the Buddha lived. That's where you find where his body lived. If you want to find out where his mind hung out, it's in those jhanas. And if you experience one of those jhanas, woohoo, now you understand how a Buddha felt. That's really cool. Anyway, that is mind objects, yours, even the Buddha's are the same. You're quite aware what causes the arising of the mind objects, how they're native to cease, they're not permanent. You're by contemplating mind objects cause the nature by the arising ceasing, or might be just mind objects, impermanent suffering, me not mind, not a soul. Establishing you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom, it's essential for liberation. So your mind is not yours, whatever arises in your mind is not yours. So free! Nothing is yours, you don't have anything. So nice to be ownerless. Anyway, how your mind and mind job is. That's it. Squat up, anymore. That's enough. Some is had to put out. So it was with reference to this that we said the four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only to the purification of beings that go beyond sadness and crying, for the disappearance of physical and mental suffering, to the attainment of true ways to the realization of Nibbana. That is the four Satipatthanas. Okay.
Samadhu.